This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture, with me, Neil Denny. This week, a special bonus edition of Little Atoms, recorded live at the Winchester Science Festival, in conversation with Professor Dame Jocelyn Bell Burnell. Professor Dame Jocelyn Bell Burnell attended the University of Glasgow, where she received a bachelor's degree in physics. She proceeded to the University of Cambridge, where she was awarded a doctorate in radio astronomy. As a research assistant at Cambridge, she aided in constructing a large radio telescope and in 1967 discovered pulsars, which has been described as the greatest astronomical discovery of the 20th century. She was made a CBE in 1999 and a Dame in 2007, and became a member of the Royal Society in 2003. She also served as President of the Royal Astronomical Society from 2002 to 2004, and was elected to a two-year term as President of the Institute of Physics in 2008. This interview was recorded live in front of an audience at the Winchester Science Festival on Saturday the 26th of July 2014. Jocelyn, let's start at the beginning. Mm-hmm. I want to talk about your early life and your first interest in astronomy, particularly the influence of your father, because it's quite an unusual influence that he had, isn't he? He wasn't a scientist.
He was an architect. Mm-hmm. And architecture's interesting because it's truly interdisciplinary. You have to be good at design, but you have also to be good enough at science and engineering that your building stands up. Mm-hmm. So I would say he was both. Mm-hmm.
But he built an observatory.
He was the architect of Armagh Observatory, most of which had been around for 200 years. But he was involved in building some new buildings for them, including a planetarium mm-hmm. at the observatory.
So did that spark an interest in you?
No.
No. So where did it come from?
As soon as we started doing science, which was about age 12 mm-hmm. in the education system I was in, it was clear that I was good at science, especially physics. Chemistry was okay. In biology, in that first year, we drew flowers, labelled the parts and learnt the names, and I found that a bit boring. Mm-hmm. So biology's been out ever since. But then it was a case of what kind of physics mm-hmm. might I do, and I was not at all sure. My father was very widely read and had immense general knowledge. There used to be a radio programme called Brain of Britain, and he was the Northern Ireland finalist for it for several years because we were brought up in Northern Ireland. So he, huge general knowledge, very widely read, and brought home stacks of interesting library books, which I would kind of check over each time he brought a new lot home. And one day he brought home some astronomy books, mm-hmm. including Fred Hoyle's Frontiers of Astronomy. And I didn't just check them over, I purloined them and took them off to my bedroom to read. Looking back on it, they were quite a steep read for a 14-year-old, but I ploughed my way through them and thought, this is great. I could already see that the physics I was learning at school about the way things moved could be applied to the galaxies, and things about heat and temperature could be applied to the stars. Mm-hmm. So I decided, if I could, I'd be an astronomer.
And were you at school, would you have been encouraged at that time to pursue that? Would a girl at school in Armagh at that particular time be encouraged to study physics and astronomy?
When we started doing science at age 12, first year of secondary school, I can remember the first week of secondary school very, very well. Partly the excitement of starting a whole load of new subjects and different teachers, and you moved around from classroom to classroom. Big, big change from primary school. But on the Wednesday of that first week, a message went round the first year class that afternoon, the boys were to go to such and such a place and the girls somewhere else. And I initially thought, this is for sport, that's why they're separating us. But it wasn't. They sent the boys to the science lab and the girls to the domestic science room. The assumption was that the girls would do domestic science. The assumption was that the girls would get married. At that stage, they were also limiting the number of girls who passed the 11 plus, mm-hmm. because there really wasn't much point in educating the girls. So I kicked up a fuss, which achieved nothing. I told my parents that night, and they hit the roof. And next time the science class met, there were all the boys and three girls. Myself, a local GP's daughter, and her cousin. And the teacher made us sit in the front row right under his nose as if we were dynamite or something. So that was my introduction to science, a bit of a fight.
Mm-hmm. So I want to carry that theme on because you go to study at Glasgow University initially. So what was that experience like as a young woman who was going to study that subject?
Yeah, that was interesting. I'd had most of my secondary education at a girls' boarding school in York. I hadn't stayed that long in Northern Ireland, and this was a Quaker girls' boarding school, which is pretty good, but we were rather protected. And I felt I want to get out in the real world, mm-hmm. So I went to Glasgow and overdid it slightly. I was keen on doing astronomy, but decided to do a first degree in physics as a kind of fail-safe. You do astronomy by studying it in universities, and I wasn't sure I was bright enough to be a university academic. Mm-hmm. If I did a degree in astronomy, that was really the only option open to mm-hmm. me. If I did a degree in physics, there were lots of options open to me, including moving into astronomy. Mm-hmm. So as a kind of fail-safe, I did a physics degree. And the honours class, the final 2 years, there were 50 of us, 49 men and me. It was a bit isolated, made more so by the fact that it was the tradition at that time in Glasgow University that when a female entered the lecture theatre, hold on to your recorder, every guy...
Oh, I should have gone to the recorder. You were right.
And whistled and stamped and catcalled. And that's okay if there's several women, but if you're on your own, you have to face that on your own every lecture.
Would this have meant, like, somebody who was, say, just walking in to the lecture theatre for another purpose, perhaps to, you know, just visiting, delivering something, and they hadn't necessarily encountered a student that would be in the class all the time? Or is this the way that they were confronting you as a student because they thought you weren't welcome?
They were doing this to every female mm-hmm. student, caretaker, mm-hmm. janitor, staff. It was a gender thing.
You decide to study radio astronomy mm-hmm. as opposed to astronomy, mm-hmm. non-radio astronomy. So give us a brief description, first of all, of what radio astronomy was at that time and why you decided to choose that path. Okay.
Radio astronomy was one of the new astronomies then. Post-Second World War, there was, tempted to say, explosion. Pre-Second World War, there was optical astronomy. There was a little bit of infrared. And there might have been... No, there couldn't have been ultraviolet. A little bit of infrared. Herschel had discovered the existence of infrared radiation from the sun. Post-Second World War, Wernher von Braun's rockets allowed the opening up of outer space. Satellites could be launched on rockets. And subjects like X-ray astronomy, where you had to get your equipment above the Earth's atmosphere, opened up and boomed. And arising out of radar, the people with radar techniques went back to university and started doing radio astronomy using sort of the receiving end of radar kit. Radar transmits and receives. Radio astronomy just receives. So radio astronomy grew following Second World War. To begin with, I only knew about optical astronomy. And on one occasion, after I decided I'd like to be an astronomer, my father took me to Armagh Observatory to meet some of the staff. And they were very kind, and they showed me the telescopes, and they showed me this and that. And then one of them said, "You have to be very good at staying up at night, because you work at night." And all teenagers need their beds, but I seem to need my bed more than many. And I thought, oh God, I can't do this. I'll have to find something else. And then I don't quite remember how I got to hear of radio astronomy and these other astronomies. Mm-hmm. And certainly radio astronomy you can do day and night, because at radio wavelengths the sun does not dominate the sky. Mm-hmm. It's there, but you can see lots of other stars and galaxies as well.
Sure.
So you can do radio astronomy 24 hours of the day, and you normally use office hours.
Mm-hmm. So at that time as well, there's an amazing new facility opened up in radio astronomy, Jodrell Bank, up outside of Manchester. And you do some work there initially, don't you?
I worked there as a summer student one summer, which was very exciting. I was there for the first ever open days at Jodrell Bank, inundated by thousands of people. inadequate access for traffic, inadequate car parking. As a student, I was being used to ferry the admission money to somewhere safe, so I was walking around with thousands of pounds. This is 1964. Thousands of pounds in my pockets, ferrying him from the admission booth to the central building. It was hugely exciting, but it's a bit ad hoc.
But you didn't end up staying there. Why not?
No, I did apply there, but the application apparently got lost. I was keen on doing radio astronomy at PhD, a research degree, and I thought, well, I'll never get into Cambridge, so I'd better head to Australia, where they also had a big radio astronomy group, very active. But Southern Hemisphere academic year doesn't begin in October, it doesn't begin till late January, so I had several months in hand. And I put in an application to Cambridge just in case, and very much to my surprise, got in. Still surprised I got in, but yeah, got in.
So, first of all, I want to talk about, before we talk about why you were at Cambridge, what you were going to do there, you built the radio telescope that you used, or not single-handedly, but a number of people built a radio telescope. So tell us about this radio telescope. What was it like to build it? What was the scale of it? Why were you having to build it yourself?
This wasn't that so abnormal at that time. Indeed, when we all turned up as graduate students, we got given a set of tools. A pair of pliers, a pair of long-nose pliers, a pair of wire cutters, and a screwdriver with an insulating handle. And these aren't the microelectronics kit that you might get given today. These are, you know, are the standard chunky size things. And they're for wire working, and very good for it too. So, you know, that sends out quite a strong message to a new arrival. You're going to be doing some physical work with wires. And that's largely what building a radio telescope is.
So we're not talking about, I've mentioned Jodrell Bank, where people will picture a huge dish,
it's
but we're not talking about
dish,
that.
No. It looks more like the kind of frame you might use for growing hops, or a giant version of a fruit cage or something like that. But it was big. It was 4 acres.
So a field of hops.
Yeah, a good field of hops. You could fit 57 tennis courts into that area. It gives you an idea of the size.
And what was the purpose of this telescope? So what were you there to do? Because obviously we're going to get to your discovery of pulsars, but of course that was accidental. You're not there to look for pulsars, you're there to look for something else.
Yep. My thesis advisor, Tony, had got a grant, I think it was about £10,000, which sounds derisory these days, to build this radio telescope. And his proposal was for studying quasars. Radio astronomers had known about quasars, quasi-stellar radio sources, quasi-stellar radio stars, for probably about 5 years. And they were a big, big puzzle. They were very strong radio objects, but when the optical astronomers looked at that spot, they could see a funny-looking star, hence the quasi-stellar radio source. But just in 1963, a Dutchman working in the US, Martin Schmidt, had been looking at the optical spectra, the colours from these funny-looking stars. They were largely featureless, but there were one or two lines in them. And he suddenly had a ghastly thought. That could be hydrogen line redshifted by a large amount. It turns out he was right. Now, a redshift of a large amount means that the thing is receding from us. A fair clip. The deeper you look into the universe, the further back in time you look, the closer to the Big Bang, the faster the expansion. So seeing something moving at a fair clip probably means it's at a fair distance. Indeed, it was at a huge distance compared with what they're used to. But that creates another problem. Think of a line of streetlights down a street. The distant ones are dimmer than the one right by you because they're distant. These objects are flipping bright and they're at a huge distance. If you went and stood under one, it must be absolutely blinding. They're amazingly bright. How do they do it? What are they? Well, we now know that they're galaxies with a massive black hole in the centre, and the black hole is being extremely active. Many, many galaxies have black holes in their centre, including our own. Our own's is tame, dull, inactive, at least at the moment. A Quasars 1 is going full belt, being as active as it can. And that's how you see them at these phenomenal distances.
So you just said black holes. At this point in history, a black hole is something that's been perhaps conjectured, but we don't really know about. And we'll come back to that, because the pulsar discovery perhaps plays into that a little bit. We'll come back to that further on in the interview. But I want to talk about a typical day studying the data from this from this radio telescope. How were you getting the data out of it? What did that data look like? What was your typical working day? We'd have to talk about lunch, but you know, the typical data gathering day.
Or not breakfast.
No. Okay. But what were you doing?
Well, I think maybe we need to close another loop for the sake of the audience.
Okay.
The radio telescope that we built was to find more quasars. Mm-hmm. We only knew of about 10 or 20. And I was the first person to use the telescope, and my project was to find more quasars. And I did. I, you know, multiplied the number of known quasars by five or six. The thing that was peculiar about the radio telescope is that we were looking for fluctuations in brightness of the quasars. And so we were working with short integration time, short exposure, whatever phraseology people are most comfortable with, so as we could see the fluctuations and not smear them out. When the telescope was built, I was left to operate it on my own with some supervision from Tony. Mm-hmm. He came out to the observatory occasionally, but he was there for consultations. And the idea was you would scan the sky and look for these fluctuating, twinkling quasars. And so we operated the telescope with four beams looking in slightly different directions. The telescope was very firmly grounded. It looked due south, but we could orientate how high or low we looked with these four beams. And on day one, we scanned the four highest strips, day two, the next highest, day three, day four. Day one, we went back up and did the next the highest again, five, six, seven, eight, and so on. And because this was largely pre-computers, University of Cambridge had a computer, which occupied a very large room and had less memory than your laptop. Most people didn't have access to a computer, and we didn't. So the paper came out, the data came out on paper charts, and there was 96 feet of paper chart every day, 120 foot-ish, if I got my sums right, 120 metres per complete four-day sky scan. Mm-hmm. And I ran the telescope for 6 months, so I had 3 miles of paper.
And you had to read that closely.
That paper, I can assure you, has been scanned every tenth of an inch of it, some of it twice over.
So what did you find? Let's get to the point then where you find something a bit odd looking.
Well, first thing you find is man-made interference. A big radio telescope like that is very, very sensitive. And if anywhere in this vicinity there's a badly suppressed car, which there were, you know, badly suppressed cars in the 1960s, or arc welders or sparking thermostats, this radio telescope picked it up beautifully and swamped all the cosmic signals. So the first thing you picked up was interference. But you got to recognise it. You knew the kind of squiggles it produced on the paper chart.
Sure.
And then the other thing you picked up was quasars, the fluctuating, scintillating, twinkling quasars. And you got to know what they look like. But as I went through the charts in this first month or so, first few weeks, there was just occasionally something that I couldn't convince myself was interference and couldn't convince myself was a scintillating quasar. There was another funny signal, a bit scruffy, so I referred to it as the scruff, which will translate okay to English audiences, but if there's anybody overseas, you probably don't know what we're talking about, but tough. And it wasn't often there, and I logged it with a question mark. And I had this brave new world idea that with, you know, 120 metres of paper per sky scan, no way am I going to remember what was on the last sky scan. I come to each fresh four-day sky scan with no preconceptions of what I'm going to see. But in fact, I was underestimating the human brain. I don't know if others here have had this experience, but for instance, doing science exams, if there were things I understood, I was comfortable because I knew I could reconstruct the argument. If there are things you don't understand, you have to learn it off parrot fashion, and you're much more vulnerable because if they ask the question in a slightly different way, you're in trouble. And so I always tried to understand as much as I could, but there were always some bits of physics that I had to learn parrot fashion, at least for the time being. Well, this peculiar signal I didn't understand. And like the bits of physics I didn't understand, it got filed in the back of my brain to be understood later, as soon as possible. And after seeing it a few times, my brain said, oh, you've seen something like that before, haven't you? You've seen something like that before from that bit of sky, haven't you? And then it's easy, because all these rolls of paper each covers one particular strip of sky. It's called declination in astronomy. And I had them filed in shoeboxes, labelled with which strip it was. So you go get out the shoebox that covers this strip of sky. You find a large area of floor, because you've got feet and feet and feet of these things, and you spread them out. And you say, well, on that day, it's not there. On this day, oh, yeah, it might be there. Oh, yep, that's one of the ones I logged. Yep, it's there. No, 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 yes. So sometimes when we look at that bit of sky, we see this funny signal, whatever it is. Still no clue what it is. Doesn't fit any known patterns. It's absolutely crazy in several other respects, but we know where it's coming from.
I'm Marcus Chown, and you're listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
Denny, and you're listening to me in conversation with Professor Dame Jocelyn Bell Burnell at the 2014 Winchester Science Festival.
So it's relevant to say, because what happens later in the story, that when you report this to Tony Hewish, your supervisor, he's sceptical.
He's not at that stage, because we haven't unpacked really what it is. And unpack is the word. We're running the chart paper fairly slowly, 5 minutes to an inch. Which means everything's jammed up quite small. And this funny signal occupied about a quarter of an inch. And you couldn't really see, other than the fact that the pen was squiggling a bit. It was all jammed together. So you have to get an enlargement, which means when you're dealing with paper charts, you run the paper faster under the pen and it gets spread out. So it's easy. You switch the chart recorder to a higher speed. But actually, that's not very clever, because the chart recorder runs out of paper in 20 minutes. And it means the grad student, me, has to live at the observatory day and night putting a fresh roll of paper in every 20 minutes. And that's no life for anybody, even a student. So the next best thing is the student goes out to the observatory shortly before the telescope's due to look at this bit of sky, switches to a high-speed recording, lets it run at high speed for 10 minutes or so across the crucial bit of sky, and switches back to normal. So that's what I did, very diligently for 28 days, and nothing showed. And Tony was livid. It's a flare star, it's been and gone and done it, and you've missed it. You know, graduate students are like the cat, they're for kicking. You know, relieve supervisors' frustrations. But after 28 days, I thought, sod this. You know, my dedication was wearing a bit thin. There was an interesting lecture in Cambridge that clashed with the time I should be out at the observatory. And I thought, I'm going to Mitch. I'm going to go to that lecture. And I did. And next morning when I went out to the observatory for the routine chart change, it had come back. And I hadn't been there. I'd Mitched. I didn't dare tell anybody or say anything. Stayed at the observatory till the relevant time, switched the high-speed recording, and in came pulse, 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 pulses 1 1/3 seconds apart. Now, crikey. The snag is, with this kind of telescope, it's rooted in the Earth. And as the Earth turns, the telescope looks at a different bit of sky. So after a couple of minutes, I could no longer look at this thing. Been trained as a good scientist always to do a test. What the hell can you test when your telescope's turned away from? So that was a bit stressful for a grad student. And I ended up phoning my supervisor who was teaching in Cambridge and said, "Hey, Tony, that funny bit of scruff, it's a string of pulses 1 1/3 seconds apart." "Oh, that settles it. It's man-made." I didn't actually think that was the right conclusion, but couldn't marshal the argument fast enough. But some of you will know that the stars get 4 minutes earlier each day. It takes the stars 23 hours, 56 minutes to be there, set, rise, get back to there. So they're 4 minutes earlier each day. That's sort of half an hour a week. And I'd been tracking this object now for several months, so it was several hours shift. And man-made things normally operate to a 24-hour schedule, except astronomers. If it was man-made, it had to be other astronomers. So Tony wrote to all the observatories saying, "Have you had a programme going since August which could possibly cause interference?" "No, of course we haven't," came back the reply. So we had this funny man-made signal coming from somewhere.
So let's get down to what it is then. What is it? What's a pulsar?
It turns out that a pulsar is a very, very compact object, about 10 miles across. They're created inside supernova explosions when the iron-nickel core shrinks to a ball that's rock-hard and 10 miles across. They are kicked against in the explosion, if you like. The explosion doesn't happen at the centre of the star. It happens a little bit out. It compresses...
A sort of implosion.
Implosion of the inner core, and everything else gets scooshed out into space.
And it's incredibly dense.
Yeah, because it weighs about the same as the Sun. 10 to the power 27 tonnes, 10 to the power 30 kilograms. That's, if I got the number right, I think it's 1,000 million, 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 million tonnes, all in 10 miles diameter.
And why is it pulsing?
They're not all pulsing, but the ones that pulse are pulsing because they're sending out a beam of radio waves which sweeps around the horizon like a lighthouse beam sweeps around the horizon. And if the Earth's on the track of that beam, it gets a pulse each time the beam shines on the Earth.
And that's incredibly regular, that pulse.
Well, yes, because once you've got 1,000 million, 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 million tonnes spinning, it's the devil's own job to make it change its spin.
So you mentioned that it was a possibility, it was thought it was a possibility that it might have been a man-made object when it was first spotted. But at the same time, I mean, there's this sort of, is it, I don't even know if it's a true story or apocryphal, that it was codenamed LGM-1, Little Green Men 1, initially. So was there ever any idea that it could be a intelligent life elsewhere signal?
Yes, Tony wondered whether it could be Little Green Men out in space, and argued that if it is Little Green Men out on space, they probably live on a planet going round their sun. And as their planet comes towards us, the pulses pile up on each other a bit, the space between them smaller. And as their planet moves away from us in its orbit round their sun, the pulses are more spread out. So one of the things we were doing was checking whether there was any change in the pulse period, the pulsation rate. We found a change, but it's due to the motion of the Earth round the sun, because that creates the same effect. We saw no sign of any motion of the source.
So you discovered the first four pulsars.
Yep.
How many have been discovered since?
We're pushing about 2,000 now.
And how different is the science that does it now? What's changed over the years since you discovered them?
There's a lot more people doing it.
Sure.
It's been a hugely, and still is, a hugely exciting area. So there are actually a lot of people working in it. We're coming up to 50 years post-discovery. And normally when a research area gets that old, it's still interesting, but it's kind of settled down into middle age. This flipping field is behaving like a teenager. There are unexpected, jaw-dropping discoveries rolling in year by year by year. It's still incredibly dynamic, hugely exciting.
What does this discovery tell us about our understanding of the wider universe? So I mentioned this idea that it gave credence to the idea of black holes. So how what has it done to change wider astronomy and our wider understanding?
It became clear fairly quickly that we were dealing with very massive, very compact objects, very dense objects. The idea of neutron stars, which is what they are, had been around for a bit, but nobody had taken them very seriously because they thought they were unobservable, too faint and all that. But suddenly these things, 10 miles across, 1,000 million, million, million tons, density like the density of the nucleus, are real. And people start saying, well, I wonder if those black holes that some theoreticians have been muttering about might be real also. Mm-hmm. So they made black holes seem more possible, more plausible. And indeed, we have subsequently found black holes.
This is obviously a huge discovery at the time, to the extent that it was, you know, it was in the popular press. It wasn't just a discovery written up in Nature or something and known among scientists. So how did the press react to it? How did they react to you?
It was a very interesting period. We published the paper in a regular scientific journal called Nature. Incidentally, some of my colleagues, their parents, were terribly upset when they told them they had a paper in Nature. They thought Nature was a nudist magazine. It's actually a highly respectable, very respectable, prestigious scientific journal. And one journalist who was slightly more perceptive than others said to us, had we ever considered it could be signals from extraterrestrials? And being honest folk, we said yes. And the press descended. And when they discovered that S.J. Bell was female, they descended even faster. And interviews followed a fairly typical pattern. We might first of all have to brief the journalist about the difference between moons and planets and stars and galaxies. But having done that, they then asked some fairly intelligent questions. But they'd put the astrophysics questions to Tony, my supervisor. And I was there for the human interest, which was kind of page three, human interest. How many boyfriends did I have at once? What were my vital statistics? I forgot. How tall was I? I didn't know. Was I taller than Princess Margaret or not quite so tall? And the photographers were saying, could I undo one or two more buttons on my blouse, please, for the photographs? I actually felt like a piece of meat, and I would have loved to have been very, very rude to them. But I was still a graduate student. The laboratory could do with the publicity, and I could do with references from the laboratory. So I had to hold my tongue. But it was not a good experience.
So we get now then to the part which I'm sure you're sick to death of talking about, but we're going to cover it anyway. The Nobel Prize of 1974 mm-hmm. is awarded in part for the discovery of pulsars to Tony Hewish, your supervisor. So should you have won it?
There was a subsequent Nobel Prize for pulsar work in 93 or 94, which went to a supervisor and his student, mm-hmm. though they were closer in age, it has to be said. These days, it undoubtedly a student would be included. But back then, the picture we had of how science was done was there was a senior professor, male, white coat optional, senior professor who had under him a load of research assistants and students who weren't required to think. He did the thinking and they carried out his orders. Mm-hmm. And the pattern was that if things went well, the supervisor, the professor got praise. If things went badly, the supervisor, professor got the blame. Mm-hmm. And the others were untouched either way. We've subsequently learned that actually we do science more in community, more in groups. Sure, there is somebody who's the principal investigator, but there'll be people of all stages of research experience in a group, each contributing according to their strengths. And incidentally, the more diverse your research group is, the better it is, because the more angles it has on something. This is creating a problem for prize committees these days, and I serve on some of them, because the rubric for these kinds of prizes, Nobel Prize included, are that it shall not be allocated to more than a few people. In the case of Nobel, three people, sometimes only two people. And if you've got to recognise a whole research group, what does the prize committee do? You'll now find that the professional bodies, bodies like the Institute of Physics, are creating prizes for teamwork, group mm-hmm. work, because this has become such a problem, because we have now totally changed the picture of how science is done. Mm-hmm.
This is speculation, and it's a ridiculous thing to speculate, really, but we'll do it anyway. If you'd have won the Nobel Prize in 1974, would we be here talking about it now at this science festival? There's an idea of almost that some of the subsequent honours that you've got, you know, you've been made a dame, have happened almost as a result of not winning the Nobel Prize. Would you agree?
I would agree, totally, yes. It's also been much more fun. I got to go to Sweden as the guest of somebody else who got a Nobel Prize in 1993, and I've seen the Nobel Prize ceremony and all the associated events, and it's an absolutely stellar week in Stockholm. It's fantastic. It's so fantastic, it's out of this world. It's quite hard work for the prize winner, because not only do you have the official prize-giving ceremony, you have receptions and parties and lectures and this and that and the other. And at all of them, you've got to stand up and say, thank you for having us, and, you know, that kind of thing. If you go as a guest, it's a much better ploy, because you do not know that. So if you get a Nobel Prize, it's a very generous award, and there are very, very few other prizes that match it. And as a consequence, if you get a Nobel Prize, you get nothing else, because people don't feel they can match the Nobel. If you don't get a Nobel Prize, you get every other prize that moves. And every year there's a party. It's far better.
And of course, posterity records what happened. There's a room full of people here watching us talk who have come knowing Jocelyn Bell Burnell is the woman who discovered pulsars. And I bet most of these people would not know the name of Tony.
Maybe.
Just a couple of other things then before, and we'll take some questions from the audience. So you spoke earlier on about some of the various issues that you faced as a woman in astronomy, and of course there are other more mundane issues faced by, you know, a lot of women in industry. You had to raise a family while you were working as well. Part of your concerns nowadays is the role of women in science, the plight of women in science. So what have things changed? Are things easier as we've gone forward?
Things undoubtedly have changed. I reckon there's still more change needed,
sure,
but things have changed. For instance, my mother's generation did not expect to have careers.
Mm-hmm.
Younger women today very possibly will expect to have careers. The role of men has changed as a consequence. And actually that's quite a fast change for society, because changing social attitudes is usually fairly slow and pretty painful. But there has been huge changes, I judge, in the role of women and the role of men in British society over the last 50 years. I sometimes reckon it's my generation that's been at the cutting edge, the turning point. And that's not always a comfortable place to be, but so be it. There is still more change needed. For example, raising children is still very much women's work. I accept that the women have to give birth to the baby and maybe nurse it to begin with, but thereafter it doesn't have to be women's work. And I welcome the development, more in some countries than here, for increased paternity leave, so that fathers can take time off and get to know their young child as well and share the burden.
Just one more from me then. You mentioned earlier the school in York, the Quaker school that you went to in York, and actually quite late on in your career you first spoke publicly about your life as a Quaker as well as a scientist. And I just wanted to know how you feel that has influenced not your work, but your attitude to the work and the sort of pragmatic way you've dealt with some of the ups and downs of your career, perhaps.
Well, I wouldn't like to claim that it's all due to Quakerism, because people who wouldn't claim to be religious can be equally pragmatic and ethical and great people. So I want to make that very clear to begin with. I think actually one of the strands that's perhaps important in my life is that in Quakerism, women are expected to contribute as much as men, and the women are listened to. And if you come of a community that has listened to the women, that's very empowering, even if you end up as one of very, very few women in a workplace. So I think that's probably more important.
I'm Alex Krotowski, and you're listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture. Thank you.
I'm Neil Denny. You're listening to me in conversation with Professor Dame Jocelyn Bell Burnell, recorded live at the 2014 Winchester Science Festival.
Okay, so I'm going to get the microphone on and take some questions from the audience. Let me unmute it. So can I? Okay, so the gentleman here.
You've just talked about your friend's school.
Yep. Yep. Yeah, that's inside talk. Are you Quaker?
Have you been back to your school in Armagh to talk about women into science and engineering? And if so, how long after you left did they ask you back?
Right, that's interesting. First of all, just to explain the interjection I made, Quakers have two names, either as Quakers or Religious Society of Friends, hence the correct use of the word friends. I have been back to my school. It's actually in a small town called Lurgan. It's Lurgan College. I first went back with the BBC for filming a programme, and they suddenly realised I existed, and they have been very generous to me ever since. And for instance, I've been back to do a speech day and hand out prizes. And any time I appear anywhere in Northern Ireland, a contingent from Lurgan College is there, all smartly dressed in their uniform.
Another question?
You mentioned that the pulse asked me about radio waves. Does that mean that neutron stars have a magnetic field? It's rotating? Is that what's causing the electromagnetic field?
The magnetic field is what causes the beam. You know, I talked about a beam of radio waves sweeping around the sky. The beam of radio waves seems to come from the north and south magnetic poles. Not all neutron stars are magnetised, but those that are pulsars. And just in case that's going to raise further questions, let me say, you know that here on Earth, magnetic north is not at the North Pole. Similarly, on a neutron star, it's offset. So you do get sweeping around the sky of the beam.
I've heard the phrase, and I was wondering if you could explain it. What is a binary pulsar?
Right. Our sun is unusual in that it seems to be a star on its own. The majority of stars are what we call binary stars, which means there's a pair of them that dance round each other, held together by gravity. Now, supposing one of these stars, and for the benefit of the listeners, I'm orbiting a pair of water bottles round each other. Suppose one of these stars explodes and the core becomes a neutron star or a pulsar, then you end up with a pulsar in a binary system. And that's what they're talking about.
Another question? Oh, there's a few at the top, so I think I'll say it.
You discussed that you'd seen the blips on the paper and you'd identified it wasn't the green men and it wasn't something man-made. What was the next step? How did it become?
Right. Yep. Good, an interesting question. When you see something peculiar with your equipment, whatever it is, you've got to start checking things out. And the first thing you suspect is there's something wrong with the equipment. So this was the really scary bit for me as the grad student, because I had helped build that radio telescope. I'd done all the wiring and cabling, and I was afraid I'd literally got some wires crossed, and that's what was producing this effect. So one of the things we had to do was to get a colleague with his radio telescope and his receiver to see if they could see this funny signal. And after a false alarm when they couldn't, they did. So that means it's not a fault with my radio telescope, my receiver. But this other radio telescope and receiver was on the same observatory site. So is it some funny interference flooding into the observatory site? And we had to think of all the things it could possibly be. And we wondered about radar signals bouncing off the moon and into our radio telescopes. We wondered about a satellite in a funny orbit, which came round every 23 hours and 56 minutes like the stars. Can't exist, but we had to check that out. There was a big corrugated metal hangar close to the radio telescope. Could it be a radio beam from something else bouncing off the corrugations and appearing as pulses? We went through all these kinds of checks, couldn't find anything. And then the next stage was to get an estimate of how far away the source of the emission was. And it turned out to be way beyond the solar system, but within the Milky Way. So it becomes something out in space. So you go through a sequence of tests like this.
I was just wondering, obviously there's still a really significant gender imbalance in STEM fields in general.
Yes.
What do you think we as a society need to be doing, and what also we as individuals should be doing to try and address that and to get more diversity in STEM fields?
Great. Can I have an hour to answer the question? First of all, it's clear from looking at data from other countries that this is a cultural effect. It's nothing to do with women's brains. Women in other countries are frequently in science and engineering and doing brilliantly. And I don't think a Malaysian woman's brain, for instance, is significantly different from our brains. So I think it's the culture we are embedded in. And it's a culture which still raises its eyebrows when a young woman says she wants to be an engineer or a scientist. And some people will say, oh, you can't do that. I'm hearing of a primary school down in the New Forest where the girls are being told, maybe a little indirectly, that girls can't do arithmetic. And unfortunately, when you tell girls that they can't do something, they tend to believe it. So that's debilitating. But a lot of the effect is a kind of small drip, drip, drip of negativity. There's not a lot of it directly, but there's a lot of, you know, oh, well, girls can't or girls don't, or are you sure you want to do physics? Which will change as we get more doing science and engineering and doing it successfully. The family career dilemma is still a big issue. And we can help with that with more creches and more paternity leave and flexible working and that kind of thing. But it's not the only issue around, because we've discovered that women who are not married and do not have children progress more slowly than their male colleagues. So there's another gender thing as well. And we currently suspect something called unconscious bias. When you first see a woman reading the news, instantaneous thought, is she authoritative? Or is she not? Listen to her a bit longer and you realise she is. But a lot of our decisions are like that. And women are sometimes not perceived as able as men at something. And once you learn that that's taking place and recall that in interviews that's actually when the decision's made, you can start to compensate for this. And I'm now seeing it done. I sat on a university promotions panel, I'm not going to name the university. I kept rough tally of how many female cases we had and how many were successful, and the same for males. And the males were more successful, and at the end I said, there's an issue. And they said, yes, there is. They just had training in unconscious bias. And we re-went over them, looking a little bit more carefully. And the gender balance at the end was fine. But there's quite a few issues to be dealt with.
Physics. One of the things people have talked about over the last decade or so is what they call dark matter, which I think is in North American galaxies, and they clearly do internally.
Yeah.
And I've often wondered, why is it just dark matter the atmosphere? Why is it just lots and lots of these dark cores of
all the stars? Right. Perhaps bring other people up to speed on dark matter to begin with. You may have seen pictures of nice spiral galaxies, whirlpool-shaped things. They're spinning. They're conglomerations of 100,000 million stars, and they spin. And you can work out how much gravity there is in these galaxies by basically counting stars. And then you can look and see how fast they're spinning, and it's alarmingly fast. So fast, the galaxies ought to centrifuge apart, fly apart. We have photographs of millions of galaxies. We see galaxies merging. We see none flying apart. Discrepancy is quite serious. We need about 6-7-fold more gravity than there actually is, we believe. So to solve, in inverted commas, this problem, astrophysicists have invented a substance called dark matter, which, as you say, sir, controls the spin of the galaxy, or more particularly, supplements the gravity of the galaxy and prevents the galaxy flying apart when it spins so fast. Now, it turns out that if dark matter were ordinary matter, stuff that's all around us in this Earth, the abundance of deuterium in the universe would be very, very different. And the abundance of deuterium that we see in the universe fits very nicely with this Big Bang explosion theory. And there is not room for a discrepancy by a factor of 6 or 7. So we're forced to say that dark matter, whatever it is not made of the ordinary matter with which we're familiar and whose physics we understand. Dark matter has to be something different from protons, neutrons, atoms, nuclei, and we don't know what it is. But when we find out what it is, we will have a whole new physics, 6 or 7-fold more than the physics that we've had to learn up till now, and we'll all have to go back to college to learn the new physics.
That's a good point for us to finish on then. So, Jocelyn Bell-Bunnell, everybody, please show your future.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
You've been listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by Neil Denny and was broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM.
You can find the Little Atoms podcast on iTunes, and you can follow the show on Twitter at Little Atoms.
If you'd like to donate a little money to support the show, you can do so at littleatoms.com. Thanks for listening.